get started by hearing some of them. We will wait until we have a forum to actually make any motions and or do business. So, Representative Neuer, if you want to start.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Representative Mahmoud Noor, representing Minneapolis. I'm here to introduce to you House File 1811. Members, this is a bill that will enable us to send a resolution to the President of the United States to extend DED, Deferred Enforcement Departure for Liberians, and also urge the Congress to look in a way to provide a permanent residency for Liberians. Liberia has got a unique history to the United States. Minnesota has got 30,000 Liberians, and almost more than 4,000 will be impacted by the ending of the DED by the end of this month. In 23 days, many Minnesotans will lose their status. That means they will not be able to have an opportunity to work and live and earn a living. Many of them have contributed significantly to the state. They're doctors, they're nurses, they're professionals who contribute every single day, as you will hear soon from one of my testifiers. We cannot fix the broken immigration system at the federal level. But what we can provide is to provide dignity for the residents who live in the state of Minnesota and fighting for them to continue to have a united family. Members, if this goes into effect by the end of the month, many Liberians will force to leave their young ones, their families behind. Many of them will no longer have that connection they have to the state of Minnesota. Some of them have never seen Liberia since they arrived in a childhood state. So members, this is a bill that will send a strong message that we stand with Liberians, Minnesota. With that, I just wanted to turn to Annie Yanley, who will testify on behalf of this bill.
Go ahead. Thank you, sir. Introduce yourself, say your name, and go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Annie Nyonle, and I work as a nurse at the University of Minnesota. I have been working at the U for the last 34 years. I came in this country when I was about 25 years old. Now I'm about 61 years old. I spent half of my life here. And this is a very important country for me. I have not been to Liberia since I came here. I got three kids that are in school, little kids, 12, 11, 7 years old, that I adopted. And I have been taking care of them. We that are on DED and TPS, we cannot go back to Liberia right now because things in Liberia are not right. They don't have medical system, they don't have school system, and I've been out of that place there for so long, I don't even know where to go. I don't have a place to live there for now. And so I work here as a nurse at the U on the bone marrow transplant unit. I have friends there, I have co-workers, and I take care of these patients that come in with cancer. They come in with leukemia, and I work on the same floor, bone marrow transplant, 5C, for the past 34 years I worked there. So if I'm sent back to Liberia, I don't know who's going to take care of my kids. Liberians here, we are all so afraid. People carry their passport with them because they can be arrested anytime and sent back home. We are not criminals. We got businesses. We got homes. And for me right now, I cannot even get a permanent home because I don't have a status. So I'm asking you to please, please pass this resolution. Please help us talk to the president so that he can extend the DED and also give us green card. We've been here for so long. Please do not send us back. So I'm asking all of you to please help us.
Thank you. I'm going to just take a break here because we not need to. We do have a quorum, so I'm going to put the bill on our discussion and then move forward with discussion about it. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, we do have a quorum right now. I'll move 1821. I'm sorry, 1811. And to be sent to the general register. And while we have paused, does somebody want to just make a motion relative to the minutes?
Move the minutes, approval of the minutes from March 7th.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anybody against? Okay. We have, I think we have two questions. Did I let you finish? I think you had.
Yeah.
To the end. Okay, I got distracted with the rest of this. Mm-hmm. Mr. Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, this is a resolution, and I suspect we're going to have a lot of resolutions memorializing one thing or another. So just for confirmation, under House Rule 2.05, but a member is not required to vote on any matter concerning a memorial resolution. So should this get to the floor, we would not be required to vote on it. I'm just asking for confirmation from staff, because if we're going to line these, if we're sending bills to the Senate that they're not going to deal with, and we're spending hours of time. Resolutions are probably the other thing we could spend hours of time, to which they have no weight of law, and we've studied what happens to these when they get to Washington.
Thank you, Ms. Pluska. I actually understand.
I see staff nodding, but.
Yep.
Nope. Well, I'll repeat it then. Under Rule 2.05, but a member is not required to vote on any matter concerning a memorial resolution. So once
on its face, I would agree that that's the way we should be assuming that we will operate.
This was bipartisanly drafted by this member and Ron Abrams to avoid hours on the floor debating, amending, and then attempting to vote on resolutions which really have no impact at all.
So just so that I'm clear on that, then does that infer then that we don't take it up at this particular level, or does it mean that it has no impact going to the floor?
Mr. Chair, I don't care what the committee does with it, but once it gets to the floor, if we're going to spend hours on resolutions that we don't have to vote on, I think we have other priorities.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pawlowski. I think these do mean something. This is really important to the people who are coming here to advocate for them, and so I just wanted to add that.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree that it does mean something to the people, but they better understand it has no weight of law, and when this hits Washington, when there was another chair of government operations, we researched what happened to them, and nothing happens to them.
Okay, thanks for the information in both counts. Any other comments? Mr. Kwong, Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, it became apparent that, you know, the initial immigration was under a temporary status, and 3-4 decades ago, what was the circumstances and the actual temporary status?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Huang. The temporary status was changed to DED in 2007.
Mr. Chair, I was querying because it's 3-4 decades ago that the testifier indicated they were 25, and I won't ask her to repeat her age now, but it when I did the math, it was several decades. So I assume that usually the DED is to extend a temporary status for either refugee status or there was some events. So if they came in to the United States, and I'm trying to understand, it was deferred, but when they came in, there was no status that was not through the normal channels?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huang, we do have a broken immigration system. And the problem right now that we're having is initially they were given asylum, not refugee status. They were given that asylum waiting for it to be approved, and then it went to TPS, meaning that they do have a temporary protected status. From there on, just to make sure that we had language that continued, all our congressional representatives have been supportive of getting a permanent residency for the Liberians. So thus, nothing has happened. It's the same as what's happening in DACA, what's happening in every level of immigration challenges that we have. The state won't be able to solve that. But sending a message on behalf of Minnesotans, like Anya, who has been here for more than 3 decades, who is a nurse, who has been providing help to Minnesotans, making sure that taking care of the sick, making sure that she can contribute back to the state, that's significant. So letting her go just because we don't support Liberians to stay will not be the right message to send to Congress.
Mr. Chair, discussion from or statements by the author, I did get that they came in with the refugee status?
They came...
Asylum. They came through and they got asylum and they got a temporary status. And this has been decades long. During that period of time, and then the 12, especially the 12 years with the DED, what proportionality pursued the path to citizenship?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, every one of them who is on DED is seeking just to have that permanent residency before they become citizens.
Mr. Chair, the question was during these decades, what percentage that came over with the temporary status pursued the standard process for citizenship? That's a number I was trying to find out.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have the exact numbers. Like I stated, there's more than 30,000 Minnesotans, and almost all of them have got a legal status.
Mr. Chair, if it'd be good if the author had some of that information to flesh out, because as was mentioned by another member of the committee, this is a symbolic thing. But it'd be nice for people to understand those details. And we all can agree that at the federal level, there are issues. And I just was hoping we could find out, a better understanding of process details, because we are in this asking for a process activity at the federal level. Thank you.
Representative Gomez.
I was in Cuba before, but I guess I just wanted to say to Representative Pulaski's point, I mean, none of us, we all know that we're not going to, that sending a resolution to Washington is not going to fix our broken immigration system or get justice for people who have been living in our communities and contributing to our communities for decades. But what it does do is it tells Washington. It tells our communities here. It tells the people who are directly impacted by this critical issue that we are with them, that we see them, that we see that we see what they've been doing, that we see their contributions, and that we honor them, and that we know that they are our neighbors, they are Minnesotans. And I guess I just don't want to, there are a lot of like resolutions that you can pass that are about relatively insubstantial issues, and this is a very substantial issue, and I think that we need to do anything we can do to send that message to people in power here and elsewhere, and most importantly to our neighbors who are living here with us. Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative, good morning. Thank you for thank you, actually, for working on this. I signed on to this a bill that you have, and in the sense I agree with Representative Pawlowski that it most likely won't, the Senate most likely probably won't do much on this. I know we're not supposed to mention them, but but I still think it's good. I think it's a good thing. I've been blessed in my life to work with quite a few of my coworkers at Delta Airlines with our Liberian, and I'm guessing they're much like you. They've been here. I've been there about 21 years, and we have about the same seniority. It's kind of like the legislature. We all know each other's seniority, you know, because we bid for jobs and that sort of thing. So I know they're about the same. Been here at least 20 some years. So and they're very much my friends. And they're working hard and care about their families and doing what they can. I just can't imagine. I've often thought about these things, right now we're probably hearing more about like our Mexican neighbors or something like that. But being sent to a country, I mean, I'm kind of a mutt, so I just can't imagine going back to any of the countries that my families have come from, like even pretty secure countries like Norway. I don't know what I would do, you know, all of a sudden you show up in Norway. I guess they don't really even eat lutefisk over there. I think I like it more than they do. But, so I don't even know if I could find it in Norway. But, that's a relatively safe country. All of us have studied what goes on in Liberia, and I'd hate to see my friends that I work with to go back, and I just can't imagine the danger they'd be in. So I'm glad you brought it forward. It's, I think, some of the comments about supporting our friends and neighbors, and I hope that they can get citizenship or however the pathway. But anyways, I support the effort.
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, just as a reminder to individuals, this is a House resolution. It doesn't go to the Senate. It's passed from the House floor. So we pass it from the House floor. We have 14 bills on the agenda. Now, this resolution, I'm not going to disagree with anything that was said. The problem becomes when we start stacking these up and when we have bills that we need to pass to balance the budget, because under the Minnesota Constitution, we do not deal with foreign affairs. Foreign affairs are under division of powers. They are a power of the federal government, not the states. So this just happens to be the first resolution I've seen. If we're going to stack these up on the House floor and we're going to take hours to debate things which have no weight of law and which when they go to Washington, they find a circular container or something with a lot of jaws in it to get ground up, we've got better things to do. It's not what's in this resolution. It's just resolutions, period.
Does anybody in the committee have any other comments? If not, then members, I renew the motion for the House 1811 to be referred to the General Register. And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It'll go to the General Register, or the motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Kegel.
Thank you.
to make the motion to put the bill before us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1300. And I'm not sure where
you referred to Health and Human Services policy.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1300 is the Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month. It's designating May as Maternal Mental Health Awareness. I actually just want to read the bill because I think it's really informative. The month of May is designated as Mental Health Awareness Month in recognition of the state's desire to recognize the prevalence of pregnancy and postpartum mental health issues and educate people of the state about identifying symptoms and seeking treatment options. Up to one-third of mothers report having symptoms of pregnancy and postpartum mood and anxiety disorders each year. Many more cases go unreported due to misunderstanding. Pregnancy and postpartum mood disorders are widespread but treatable illnesses. Left untreated, pregnancy and postpartum mood anxiety disorders can lead to negative effects on birth outcomes, infant development, and well-being of mothers and families. The state declares in order to educate the public that the governor may promote and encourage the observance of Mental Health Awareness Month. And, you know, being a new mom, this was something I was very much aware of going through my pregnancy, and also having dealt with anxiety and depression in the past as well. It was something that I was very aware of. And after you have a baby, you're supposed to be happy. You're supposed to be so happy, but it's really hard. You know, you're going on about an hour of sleep and then getting up and then up for 2 hours and sleeping again. And it's just, it's incredibly tough. It's probably one of the hardest things that I've ever gone through. And so I think it's really important that we let new moms know that this is something that's normal, that, yeah, you're supposed to be happy, but it's also really hard, really emotionally draining. And that we're here to support you and educate you and make sure that you're not alone in feeling some symptoms of, you know, sadness or depression or anxiety. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Rena Sugarbaker.
Yes, hi. I'm Dr. Rena Sugarbaker. I'm an adult psychiatrist, board certified in the state of Minnesota, and I work with at Prairie Care at our location in Brooklyn Park. I am a perinatal psychiatrist, meaning I work with women, new mothers, pregnant women, and new mothers in terms of helping them manage mood and anxiety and other disorders during that time frame. I'm just so excited and inspired about the opportunity that we have before us here today to pass this and move this bill along. Many families are still unaware that there are amazing resources available in our state. Many moms are afraid that getting help means you're admitting that you're a failure as a mom, or they fear having their child taken away from them. So there's a lot of confusion about what is happening during a time of your life that's supposed to be wonderful and joyous. When they suffer complications from perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, 50% of mothers who are suffering don't even seek treatment. And we need to break the stigma of these disorders and educate our community and providers so that moms can get the help that they need and deserve. Developing an awareness month in Minnesota will give us a foundation for creating events during the month of May that encourage screening, treatment, and support for mothers and their families. No mother in the state of Minnesota should suffer or die from a disorder that is common and treatable.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Come on to the podium. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Mary Troyer, and this is my husband. Well, no, you're not here. Harry Gottwald. We are the proud and happy parents of Stacy Ann Gottwald. We are also the heartbroken and sad parents of Stacy. She took her life at the age of 41 on August 16, 2016, due to maternal mental health issues. Her beautiful baby girl, Sage, was 6 months old at the time. A few days after giving birth, Stacy was having severe anxiety, and it escalated to postpartum psychosis. She saw many counselors, had ECT treatments, acupuncture, and was hospitalized 3 times at different hospitals, being admitted to their mental health units, working so hard at getting better. She did not want to go back into the hospital as she felt these programs weren't helping, and she was right. At that time, we had no idea why she was extremely anxious. Harry and I did not know what postpartum depression was. Unfortunately, many, many moms experience perinatal mood and anxiety disorders that are untreated and undiagnosed. By passing this bill designating May as Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month, the shade covering the window will be lifted up, and the window will be wide open for beautiful moms to openly talk about how they feel and what they are experiencing, and to let them know that there are services and resources to help them. If this bill passes, it would be a huge help to moms, their families, and friends, and all loved ones, and a step forward to hopefully have training and certification in areas of perinatal, postpartum, or mood and anxiety disorders at mental health hospitals, birthing centers, as well as labor and delivery units. This should never happen to another mom or have their families experience this devastating loss. It is treatable and it can be taken care of. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else? If not, questions from members of the committee? Representative Kegel, any closing words?
I just really want to thank everybody for this. You know, being a mom is hard. Being a dad is hard. And so I think, you know, the more that we can do to talk about the challenges and just realize that it is a tough thing that we go through. And so I just really want to thank the committee for hearing this bill and hope that we can get May designated Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month. Thank you.
Representative Cagle renews her motion to forward House File 1300 is referred to the Health and Human Services Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Motion is agreed to. Representative Nelson. Bill 1974.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll move House File 1974 to be referred to Ways and Means with the suggestion that it go to State Government Finance. I believe that's the proper motion.
Yep. Go ahead with your testimony.
And Mr. Chair and members, while this may look like a daunting bill when you look at the size of it, it's really a fairly straightforward and simple bill. It's just basically cleaning up language in statute. Most of the bill, if you go through it, there's pages where it's basically changing a warrant, getting rid of old language, to payment. And that's what the majority of the bill does. On page 4, there's a reference that talks about, it's a cross-reference in here of statute. where the current statute references 7.19, which is a reference to the state treasurer's office. We no longer have a state treasurer. We used to have one, but that's been eliminated, and moves it to the 16A.271, which is the Department of Admin. And that's probably the most substantial piece of it. And then on page 6, there's language that talks about, and it goes into about Department of, or the Commissioner of Admin, of getting unpaid claims and of getting, declaring debts that unowed debt and what, how to collect that debt and or determining which debt is uncollectible. And that's the meat of the bill. And I stand for questions.
Is there any questions for the author? Seeing none, you want to renew your motion?
I renew my motion of the House File 1974 be sent to Ways and Means with the recommendation that it consent to state government finance.
All those in favor of the bill signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. You have your next bill.
Here, House File 1975. That was a good year. And basic 1975 is, while it's a lot shorter, it's also a very straightforward bill. In statute, we have different ways of contracting for work, contracting for building.
You want to move the bill?
I'll move House File 1975 to be referred to Ways and Means with a forwarded to state government finance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, again, this is a straightforward bill. Again, we have different forms of contracting. Most people are aware of the bid process, where it's a low bid, gets the job. We also have best value. We also have responsible contractor. We have other different ways. What this bill does is it adds the words award based on competitive bids is the best and final offer piece, which is part of other forms of contracting that it is not used in when you do competitive bidding. And that's what the bill does.
If you're a testifier, you want to introduce?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Hayes. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer with the Department of Administration's Office of State Procurement. And as Representative Nelson suggested, the bill is very short and simple, but it does have very much very big significance for the procurement officials who are working to enter into building construction contracts. Basically, the bill makes an important clarification that the prohibition on using best and final offers relates to competitive bidding, and it does not, therefore, prohibit the use of that important tool when we're doing RFPs, or in other words, requests for proposals, when we evaluate and score based on the proposals received. In that kind of a procurement method, negotiation and use of BAFOs is an industry practice and a very important tool to assure that our professionals are getting the best value for our building construction contracts that are saving resources and time and money. So we would appreciate support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, because I'm not familiar with all of the ramifications of all of the different bidding processes, but I have concerns for small businesses a lot of times trying to bid on government contracts because it makes it very difficult for them to go through all of the minutia. Would this have any effect on the ability of a smaller contractor to bid on a project?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, this is part of this best value and responsible bidding contractors and design build, all those are actually designed to help smaller contractors as opposed to the normal, what people think of the straight bid, the bid and process. And it's designed to help them. And this, like I said, this clears up language that's in 16C that talks about the best and final offer solicitation may not be used in building construction contracts by adding that awarded on competitive bids, which means they can use that for other types of contracting. So when they're getting into that negotiating process, they can make a best and final offer, and it helps get those awarded. And it actually helps smaller contractors DBE contractors to get those, get some of this work that the state does.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Vogel? Okay. Anyone else have questions regarding this particular bill? Any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, this is a simple bill, and I look for your support.
I'll renew your motion.
I'll renew my motion that House File 1975 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with the recommendation that it go to State Government Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill is passed. Your next bill, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are my re-election bills, if you didn't know. I'll move House File 1997 to be referred to the General Register.
Go ahead.
And, Mr. Chair, I have an amendment. When the bill came forward, there were some people in that had some concerns. Let me find the amendment here. There we go. It's the A-154 amendment. You should have that.
A-19?
A-19-0154. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Read the number right.
Yeah, sorry. You're going to, then you're moving that forward.
I'll move the author's amendment. And, Mr. Chair and members, what the amendment does is the bill originally just eliminated the sunset date on here on the job order contracting that for the Hennepin County. And there's been some concern about that. So instead of removing it, we're just extending it. Currently, the sunset date on this is December 31st. 2019, which is this year, and it just moves it out 5 years to 2024. And so that's what the amendment does.
All those in favor of the author's amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, Mr. Nelson, or Representative Nelson.
And members, again, this is about Hennepin County and their job ordering contracting that they do. And again, it's a tool that the county uses, as Representative Vogel asked about small contractors. It helps small contractors get some of the work that the county does. Okay. And DBE contractors that to get that work and to help build up those contractors through this process of being able to get the work through the county. And I have somebody here from the county if we have questions. But basically what the amendment does is changes the bill. Instead of eliminating the sunset date, it just extends it out 5 years.
Any committee members have questions? I don't see any. Go ahead with your final remarks, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for letting me have the bills heard. And I'll move that House, renew my motion that House File 1997 be re-referred to Ways and Means with the recommendation that go to State Government Finance.
As amended.
Thank you.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
According to our notes, this was going to go to the General Register.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I'll revise my motion that House File 1997, as amended, be sent to the General Register.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank
okay.
you, members. Thank
I think we have exhausted your...
We've exhausted the wines for today, yes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mariani.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Good morning. Go ahead and introduce your bill. Or, I'm sorry, I'll move House File 717 to be recommended to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, that's a correct motion. Thank you. And there is an amendment in your packet. If you would be so kind, it's an author's amendment. To put the bill in the shape, I wish it to be before you.
All those in favor of the author's amendment?
And Mr. Chair, I think it's coded A-19-0158.
That's what we're trying to find out for sure here. A19-158 is the amendment. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like this is a DE amendment that rewrites the bill, so I'm wondering if we can just kind of cover it briefly before we vote on it.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members, the DE amendment does no substantive change to the purpose and intent of the bill. It basically makes some changes in terms of individuals that we're naming. It removes the governor as a member of the Cannabis Task Force. It adds three categories of members to the task force: the defense attorney, a person previously incarcerated in a correctional facility, and a medical doctor appointed by the Board of Medical Practice. It makes it clear that the Commissioner of Health or his designee is convening the first meeting instead of the governor. And then it adds a couple, it actually does add a couple of substantive pieces, so thank you. They're not major, but that the comprehensive plan and report that the task force will bring back will also vet federal law policy about the regulation of cannabis, and would also consider and deliberate over the pardoning of nonviolent marijuana convictions. And then we changed the effective date to have it following enactment, because we discovered, you know, otherwise it's August, and then we only have a few months to do a big task. And it increases the appropriation from $50,000 to $100,000 appropriated to the Commissioner of Health. And members, all of those recommendations, and I'll talk a little bit about this, come as a result of engaging a broad group of legislators, stakeholders, and also the governor's office. And so the spirit of this task force bill has been to reach out broadly to engage with a diverse group of stakeholders, because the whole posture is this is not a partisan issue. It's not, you know, an executive legislative issue. It's just a needed conversation that we have. So the author's intent is to be as inclusive as possible with the bill. So
Representative Zerwas, any questions then to the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. I appreciate that walkthrough. I know I've watched the bill be presented in a few committees now, and I know you've been, this has been evolving.
Yes, it has.
And you've been very diligent in taking remarks and concerns from other members as this bill, I think, has improved with each stop. And so I don't have a problem with adopting the author's amendment, but I do have some questions following that.
Okay. Questions to the amendment? Mr. Kwan? Or Representative Kwan?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to understand if this came from discussions in the previous committee, and if there's any relations to the debate. In other words, it was in the previous committee, and it was covering certain areas. Does this tie back into, I don't know the bill should go back. You do a DE, and then do you need to go back? And if the areas are relational and the, you know, health committee should see it again, I'm just trying to become more informed on that vein.
I understand your question as you're looking at me, but I'm being asked a question above my pay grade.
It's to the author.
Author.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. This came over from Health and Human Service policy, obviously through Ways and Means. And then in that committee, I stated what I stated here, which is that we are constantly shaping for the sake of making sure that there is a truly inclusive participation. So we were very transparent with that committee that some of the recommendations that they were suggesting as they vetted the bill, as they listened to testifiers, that we would then be amending in this committee. And so from here, the bill, my expectation is once it goes back to Ways and Means, it'll go back to, or it'll go to Human Service Finance. And so you've got some overlap with those members there. My expectation is for the bill also to come to Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform. So anyway, all that by way of saying that, to your question, sir, that the we've been very upfront that this bill will consistently evolve as we're hearing from members in the committee that it's in front of.
Thank you. Okay. With that, we can vote the amendment, unless somebody else has other questions for the amendment itself. Not all those in favor of adding the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, then Representative Mariana, the amendment, the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will be very brief, and then there are some testifiers that wish to speak, and then perhaps we can get into the more technical, because I actually am looking for advice from this committee because of the expertise and scope that this committee has. You all know that there are great winds that are blowing across the nation relative to the full legalization of cannabis. Quite frankly, this bill doesn't do that. What this bill does is say that we don't want to just simply get caught up in the wind, that we want to be intentional, we want to be smart, we want to be informed as much as possible about the implications of a full legalization pathway, what has transpired in other jurisdictions. I don't have my full notes, but I think we're at around 10 states now that have a full legalization framework. And of course, you all know that our neighbor to the north, so our border, international border with Canada, just recently moved to a full legalization, so recreational for adults, legal framework for cannabis in the country. The reason I say that is not just a metaphor of winds blowing, it's that in Minnesota, along with many other states, are existing within a large context where there's a lot of pressure either to move in the same direction, or if we don't move in the same direction, to respond to the changed environment that legalization is causing across the country. There are responsible ways for us to respond to that. It's this author's opinion that simply quickly responding is not a responsible approach. And so, therefore, what this bill does is that it creates a task force, a process by which Minnesotans can take some time to dig into what would be the necessary statutory issues and frameworks that we would address if there was a legalization decision, a full legalization decision on the part of the legislature and the governor in the coming year or years, and also to really understand what the most salient issues, even beyond statutory changes, that we should be informed about if we move in that direction. And then finally, to engage in a much more inclusive, steady conversation with the general public. I'm not insinuating that we don't do that here at the legislature, but as legislators, that we're moving really fast. It's just the nature of our cycle. And as a result of that, over the years, we've pulled out a few issues and have said, let's slow down a bit. And let's have a more deliberate, careful vetting process that would then come back to our process here as well. So, again, as I said, that part of the importance of bringing this bill before this committee is that you all are the ones that are tasked to provide the best advice in terms of how to structure task forces, both in terms of, you know, fairness issues, in terms of makeup of such a task force, but also, you know, what, you know, how to actually technically structure a body like this. And so my hope is that we can have that conversation. But, Mr. Chair, there are a few testifiers that wish to come forward to speak.
Yeah,
to
the let's go ahead with the testifiers, and then if we can, because otherwise we can chew up today, tomorrow, and a couple of other days probably testifying. So if you can testify in a couple of minutes, that would be very helpful for our schedule. So hopefully 2 minutes will work. I'll give you some sort of a indication if you're going past the 2 minutes.
Mr. Chair, we have someone from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and then we also have someone from the Minnesotans for Responsible Marijuana Regulation, and then a representative from the ACLU.
Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, my name is Robert Small. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and one of the things that I could do is take a cue. The County Attorneys Association supports this bill. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laylee Fadahi, and I am a lawyer and have spent over a decade developing and advocating for robust governance and oversight approaches to complex policy issues that have significant health, economic, and social implications, including as an academic researcher at the University of Minnesota Law School, the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and the Center for Bioethics, where I spent the first half of my career. And now I'm also the campaign manager for Minnesotans for Responsible Marijuana Regulation, or MRMR. We're a statewide, multipartisan campaign and coalition that supports the legalization and responsible regulation of marijuana for safe adult recreational use in Minnesota. MRMR's steering committee and coalition members include former state senators and representatives from both the Republican and DFL parties, Minnesota business owners, justice reform advocates, indigenous community leaders, civil society organizations like the NAACP, the ACLU, Jewish Community Action, and a growing list of mayors and city council members from across the state. And we urge your support on the bill. As we've been reaching out to diverse communities and organizations and affinity groups and policymakers from all corners of Minnesota, what has been most evident above all is that Minnesotans from all walks of life want to know more, and they want to be more engaged in conversations about what legalization could mean and what legalization could look like in Minnesota, rather than just being bystanders to the less nuanced question of whether or not we should legalize. For many of these Minnesotans, it's a matter of feeling that they don't have enough information or facts. They've seen other states legalize marijuana and generate enormous tax revenues that they've invested into their roads, public programs, infrastructure, schools, but they want to know more about the implications of legalization for public health or public safety. And then so many other Minnesotans feel that given the rapidly changing public opinion in support of legalization, that we should make sure that if it happens in Minnesota, it happens in a way that benefits rather than excludes Minnesota farmers, that keeps our children safe from being advertised or sold cannabis products, and that maintains the safety of our roads and redresses the disproportionate impact that marijuana prohibition has had on people and communities of color. And that's why you see before you some letters of support, some from organizations that you've maybe never seen before step forward and support a bill related to marijuana and legalization. We think Minnesota is ready to talk meaningfully about legalization and the finer points of how it can happen, and we hope that you are ready to give them the forum and the opportunity to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself. Go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I'm also a steering committee member with Minnesotans for Responsible Marijuana Regulation. The ACLU's primary interest in this area is driven by the issue of racial disparities. Our history of criminalization of marijuana has had a staggeringly disproportionate impact on African Americans and other communities of color, and it comes at a tremendous human and financial cost. A 2013 report from the National ACLU found that blacks are almost 8 times more likely than whites to be arrested for marijuana possession in Minnesota, even though data shows that the use rates are very similar. This was the third largest disparity in the nation. This disparity is even more stark in Minneapolis, where our 2014 report found that blacks were 11 times more likely than whites to be arrested for possession. The ACLU ultimately supports the full legalization of marijuana through a system of taxation, licensing, and regulation. However, getting to the right regulation in our state will clearly take a lot of time, work, effort, and input from many stakeholders. Accordingly, we support the framework of this task force as an important step in moving our state forward on the issue of responsible regulation of marijuana. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier.
Mr. Chair, that's all we have for you.
Okay.
At least in terms of the authors.
Sure. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify who did not sign up earlier? Okay, I don't see anybody making any moves. So, members of the committee, questions for the author? Mr. Zerwas, representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, your DE today changes the enactment date to the immediacy of upon enactment, so when the bill is signed. That gives you roughly from this springish to the end of the year, as the legislation as it sits looks for a report back to the legislature January 1st next year. This is a big undertaking, I think, with as the list of stakeholders kind of grows and the size of the group grows that I would comprise of the task force, I think taking meaningful input from that group and compiling a report in that accelerated of a schedule seems ambitious and perhaps challenging. And so I'm wondering how the author would feel about looking at a report date instead of January 1st of 2020 to make that a July 1st, 2020, or a January 1st, 2021. I just want to make sure that there's adequate time for this large group of stakeholders to meet, to take kind of the multitude of things that you're asking for them to consider and report back to the legislature and put together a meaningful report that has input from this significant group. I don't oppose this bill. I appreciate what you're doing and your work on the bill. I've been on task forces with healthcare workforce, with elder abuse, with we had a task force I met over the interim having to do with granny cams and looking at using cameras in nursing homes to kind of prevent or discover elder abuse. And the one thing that is common in all of my experiences in being appointed to and serving on these task forces is that the actual compilation of a meaningful report and getting that work back to the legislature is significantly more involved than you usually give credit to up front. And I have certainly not served on a task force with a membership as wide ranging and large as the task force that you're proposing. And so I'm just wondering what your thought is on perhaps looking, re-examining the timing and the expectation for a deliverable.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the question, Representative Serwas. You arrive at the balancing act that this bill attempts to do and that I've tried to provide some leadership for. By the way, just very quickly, my intent is to change the reporting end date to February. It buys me another month. But you know, we're not going to start the legislative session until sometime in February. Not that I have a crystal ball, but typically we have not begun the off year any earlier than February. I think last year we even pushed right up to March, if I remember. And so, you know, being able to pull something together during the holidays season just didn't seem right, frankly, to my wife, but I suspect to many other members' spouses as well. Let me just say that, as I said, there is a balancing interest here, and quite frankly, the balancing interest is really about there is a strong movement and push. And so I use that metaphor of winds that are blowing. Those are national and international in scope. Again, regardless of whether we act or not, all of that is changing the context all around Minnesota rapidly, whether you're engaged in law enforcement or you're part of, you know, monitoring, our transportation, our commerce flows. There certainly is a strong desire, certainly for those who want to move toward legalization immediately, but even those who are hesitant about that but nonetheless are responding to dynamics around us, for rigorous and yet urgent, vetting. And yet you still have to have vetting. And so that's the balancing, piece here. Let me just say that I think under perhaps other circumstances, I would be more warm to your recommendation. Certainly I've been involved in those kind of vettings in the past that have taken us out a couple of years. The goal that I am proposing is that this political environment own this issue. And by coming back, after we're done with the regular legislative session next year, it really removes this political community out of any kind of decision making until the next legislature is convened. And there's nothing, however, that says that in February, we have a report. Perhaps the task force itself says, you know what, we need more time. Or the body says, great work, we need more time. There's nothing that says that you couldn't extend this out, or create some auxiliary ongoing, process. I'm hesitant to say that because, part of being able to bring together a broad group of stakeholders here is with that promise of maintaining this balance. And there are lots of folks, quite frankly, that if we're sending messages that all we're going to keep doing is kicking the can down the road, then that really breaks apart, the kind of broad consensus that you have right now, which then ultimately compromises the quality of the decision making. So there is a delicate balancing process that's at play here.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani. I just want to echo Representative Zerwas' concerns. I have the same. It's a lot of folks. 27 is what I'm counting, and I could be off. But meeting monthly is quite a task, I think, just in itself. But I am very pleased to see that you are addressing federal law, policy, and regulation, because that is a huge concern for me when we look at legalization, that we're going to go through all this work and then the federal government's going to decide something different. And I'm not hearing a whole lot, we're not getting a lot of data because right now it is a Schedule 1, so there isn't a lot of research data and such that can go on. And I think that's an important part of us getting informed about what this all means for the state of Minnesota. I do appreciate, but I do have concerns about the number of folks you have. And meeting once a month. That just sounds like herding a bunch of cats, and that's quite quite difficult to do.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, it is difficult to do. I think there is a strong will, however, that's been expressed by the folks that have come forward or have been recommended, not individuals, but the types of, whether it's an organization or whether it's the County Attorneys Association or the Minnesota Police Officers, the MMR group that we heard from before, where I have certainly picked up a strong desire not to just come in a room and bash each other, but to actually really work through as diligently as possible. So all I can offer is that I think there is a spirit of really rolling up the sleeves and working it as difficult or as rigorous as possible. The federal policy review actually came as a result of the governor weighing in and saying, we have to look at those issues. Absolutely. Otherwise, we're putting our heads in the sand on this.
Follow up and all. Representative Tice.
I'm good.
Representative Lee. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Mariani, for bringing this proposal forward. And, regarding the membership, I just want to say thank you for being inclusive and, having the different voices who may be interested in this particular subject area. And, for me, it's really important for us to have the folks who, have been punished, who were incarcerated for, maybe having possession before. And so I think that's really great. And one of the testifiers before has, talked about, how could we look at folks who, through a racial justice lens, folks who have been in the correction system before who, were, this task may, move Minnesota by forward in legalizing it. And so I think that's really great. And also, right now for the folks who are using through our medical cannabis program, I think that it's great and it's definitely needed for us to hear them. And then also having a medical doctor, I think that will assure many of my constituents who have brought forth, some of the concerns regarding some of the health impact of cannabis. And so Representative Mariani, Chair Mariani, I just want to say thank you for being inclusive and having these diverse perspectives as we move forward with this subject area.
Mr. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mariani. Thank you for taking on this challenge. It does seem that the number of supporters is growing, and it's my impression is that they're an extremely aggressive group. So the fact that you have the shorter timelines, I appreciate. But I also know that there are people that are, how would I put it, cautious about going forward. So I wish you well, and thank you again.
Is there anyone else with comment or question from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to add quickly within the spirit of transparency that in my response to Representative Kwan's earlier question that some of the recommendations that had been coming in didn't make it into the DE amendment. And so I just want everyone to know that what we're looking at right now are a couple of changes. One is to delete the Commissioner of Labor. Part of what's happening is that some of the criticisms that were offered were that by having all these commissioners, we're kind of stacking it, because of the governor's professed broad, position. And so the idea is not to remove, the governor from being able to bring folks in, but to have a little bit of autonomous, distance between him and not just as opposed to the closeness of his commissioners being there. So we're looking for community, more community-type people in those areas that are under some of those state departments. We also are looking to delete the language on 2.8 that talks about a person with experience, enforcement of state's cannabis laws. It doesn't sound as bad as it sounds because what's happening is there's some redundancy here because we do have prosecutors and law enforcement very specifically and delineated out or disaggregated out in the in the list. And that was also about making sure we don't wind up with 100 people, to Representative Tice's point. And then to modify the language in 2.16, previously incarcerated Minnesota Correctional Facility, and to make it really clear that what we're talking about is the person who was convicted of a non-felony drug-related offense, so non-felony drug-related offense, so that we can have that perspective as well. There's some other minor changes. I talked about the change to February, and then we want to add a little bit more language to line 3.20. Right now, it reads state and local regulation. This is under duties. State and local regulation of cannabis growth, processing, transport, packaging, labeling, sale, possession, and use, and then add including government structures. And what we're getting at there is for the group to think through what might be the regulatory commissions that should factor into if there's a movement toward full legalization. So all that by way of full disclosure and transparency of where this is going as we continue to hear advice from members. And I'll close by just saying that my door is open to advice from members of this committee as well.
So I just want to determine, does that constitute your closing remarks, or do you want to?
Sounds good.
Okay. With that, then, I'll renew my motion that House File 717 be forwarded to Ways and Means, as amended, that it'll move to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying yes.
Aye.
No, the same. It is move forward. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I look forward to working. If this is successful, I look forward to working with all of you.
Representative Mann. Yep. This is House File 728. I'll move that 728 will be recommended and referred to Ways and Means, with the recommendation that it go to Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. In front of you, you have House File 748, which deals with PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers, licensure, and transparency. Very fast rundown of that bill for those of you who are unfamiliar. PBMs function as the middlemen in a pretty complex healthcare system. They once had a role in negotiating for the lowest drug prices on behalf of the health carrier. And what has occurred over the years is that they have positioned themselves in a very lucrative space and began using their position as gatekeepers between the drug manufacturers and the patients. They began requiring kickbacks and rebates from the manufacturer in order to put their drugs on a formulary list that would then go out to the pharmacies and the patients. during that time, three PBMs now control 80% of the market, and they have been implicated as a large reason why drug prices continue to go up. It's my understanding that this bill needed to come to your committee today to discuss the rulemaking portion of the bill. It's pretty straightforward. The purpose is to prescribe the standards for the licensing and the reporting. We've spoken to the Commissioner of Commerce about it, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, I'm not sure exactly how you would do the language, but with we do have some of the pharmacological genomics activity from the insurance from different medical entities within the state of Minnesota, and some language that would prevent substitution, since if you have the testing and you've got the information, you're avoiding something you might have a reaction to, but you're also probably, if you use it correctly, getting the best medication and probably a good shot at the best first dosage. And I'm not sure how to protect that, but I noticed that in the language of the bill, it's, I believe it said that pharmacists weren't prevented from speaking openly. There wasn't a gag on them, And I'd hope that there could be some protections. And I know there are a few other instances of where, you know, people have pursued limiting the generic substitution and some other restrictions. I didn't know if you wanted to speak to that or what are your comments?
I'm not really sure what, but Mr. Chair, I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
What I'm asking for is you've got in here that you prevent gag orders, you know, so you're allowing the discussion in here. Part of what they do is they help push for cost savings, generics over others. So they, the mechanisms for substituting, but as we are gaining more information and individualized and medicine, there are other reasons that might not be apparent to them because they don't have access to the portal and the additional testing information. And I was looking at some protections along those lines.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Representative, so the gag clause doesn't have to do with changing medications or prescribing alternatives. It just has to do with allowing the pharmacist to offer cheaper options. And then we do have a section on pharmacists being able to prescribe equivalent drugs, but that portion was amended a couple committees ago to say that that can only happen if you have a specific written agreement with the provider. So the provider would know the answer to those questions and be able to forward that to the pharmacist.
Okay, thank you. I think you probably stepped outside the lines of this particular committee's purview, but nonetheless, I hope the answer was productive for you.
I'm assuming we may have some offline discussions.
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the testifier. On 6.22, it talks about fiduciary duty. When I see that word, it always piques my interest. How did you come about to use that term? Because it's got a lot of ramifications.
Sure. So we've talked about this in other committees as well, and I think it's a little bit outside of today. But so what happens is right now we have PBMs who are essentially beholden to their stakeholders and their shareholders. So this simply stating that PBMs have to perform their duties with the client or the health carrier in mind. It's language that has been taken from Nevada and went through court, and they sided with the side of the legislature. So that's where that came from.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I was just going to start to say we might be getting a field again because obviously it's been discussed in previous committees. So
I won't put you through telling me not to do anything.
Any other questions? I don't have anybody else on my Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mann, I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward and, you know, especially for the section that's related to our committee and, you know, really providing transparency for patients out there and for, you know, our consumers and really knowing who are these pharmacy benefit managers. And so I just want to say thank you for that so that, you know, if we do have any questions going forward, you know, for patients who need access to medications, at least we know and have the information that we need in making the right decision for us. So I just want to say thank you for that.
Any other questions from committee members? If not, Representative Mann, you want to final comments for your bill?
It's a big bill, and again, the goal is to provide transparency so we know where our patients' money is going, and we try to get a better understanding of why drug prices are increasing. So I ask for your support.
Members, I renew my motion for File 728 to Ways and Means with a recommendation to go to Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same. The bill is, or the motion is approved. Representative Tricia. Thanks for your patience hanging in there. Representative Zerwas, do you want to move this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 499. What's the Bill Bath on this. I guess I don't know.
I've got Health and Human Services Finance.
So to or Ways and Means.
Am I reading the wrong one?
Ways and Means.
The motion would be to Ways and Means. And then with.
And then.
To HHS Finance.
Yep.
That will be my motion, Mr. Chair.
All those. Oh. Ms. Crescia, or Representative Crescia.
If you want to call for a vote, I'm good with it.
Well, I can do that, but maybe you want the benefit of discussion.
No.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The only reason I'm here, and thank you for hearing us, lines 3.22 and lines 3.23, we need to adopt rules necessary to establish the training academy and so that the Department of or the Commissioner of Human Service can put those rules in place when the academy goes into effect. I have broad agreements from all many, many groups, but that's really the only reason I'm here.
Members of the committee, are there any questions of this bill? Any members of the audience who have questions, or I'm sorry, would have testimony? Seeing none, final statement? I think that probably was it.
Thank you for letting me come.
I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee member.
Sorry for the long wait for a very short.
I can make up time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Herr, going in.
Chair Salk, I should maybe just hand it over to you all the time. You're running this so efficiently. I must bog things down.
You ready?
Oh, no, I'm still waiting.
Okay, with that, I'll move House File 1289 to be sent to Ed Policy. There's a DE amendment.
Yes,
that
there
correct?
Is. Yes,
Office
there is.
Amendment. We can just do that.
You need to move for amendment.
Yeah. So we'll move the DE amendment. Yes, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just for the benefit of the committee, it looks like this bill was introduced and referred to the Ed Policy Committee, was heard in Ed Policy.
It's going to Finance, if I misspoke. It's Ed Policy Finance.
Yeah. But, Mr. Chair, I think with the DE amendment coming in, that really does completely rewrite the bill since it went through Ed Policy. I think this is probably something that's going to have to go back to Ed Policy, Mr. Chair. And so I think if the DE-5 is adopted here today, it would require to go back to Ed Policy since this is all policy changes that would be enacted by this group. And I've never served on an education committee, and we're not adept to have that conversation, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And we actually did have some conversations around this, and to Representative Zerwag's question. We've actually been working with the chair of the policy committee and also to explain sort of what has happened, mm-hmm. and she is familiar with the changes and understands it, and that the way it's moving through the process, it will come back to her eventually anyways. And so the chair is okay with this delete all being heard here, and that wherever it stops Education Finance, but it will eventually come back to her in its current form the way it is in this DE amendment. So I guess is there objection to this? I mean, we definitely can do it differently, but I just wanted to make sure that we get a chance to kind of explain to you how this came to be and why it is the way it is.
Representative Nelson, you have a comment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members and Representative Herr. Yeah, I think the original reason why the bill came here is because it was doing rulemaking, mm-hmm. which is a mandatory referral to our committee.
That's right.
But also creating a working group is another mandatory referral to our committee. So therefore, this is the proper committee for it to go to. And if it's going to probably wind its way back to
education, finance, or education policy, but this is the proper place to do either one of these, and from switching it from one to the other, this is the place to do it.
Representative Zerwas, does that square with you?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, if we, it sounds like from Representative Herr that this bill, after Ed Finance, will return to Ed Policy. Is that the author's intention? Because as long as this language gets back to Ed Policy, I mean, I understand we're up against deadlines, and and I'm not trying to throw a wrench in the works here. I just want to make sure that this language, which is clearly language that should be vetted by Ed Policy, is able to be seen there and vetted there. And I would be concerned if it appeared as though there was an end around in HHS, and big substantive policy changes were made on issues that didn't end up going back to the Policy Commission. Now, I'm not an education person by any stretch of the imagination, so I just want to make sure that this language gets back in front of the proper committee to validate our process here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, the intention of this bill is so that it would be included in the omnibus bill, so it has to go back to Ed Policy. So thank you for that comment and ensuring that all the right parties are involved and know what's going on. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sometimes we, and when you have omnibus bills, and we've done this in the past, and I think both sides have done this in the past, is where you have something that needs to come here before second reading. You send that portion of the bill here to be heard. And once it's heard here, it makes deadline, and then they can put the language in their omnibus bill, which means the omnibus bill doesn't have to come here because it's been heard in this committee. And that's what we're doing here.
So at this point, the motion will be that this will be forwarded to Ed Finance, okay? And we're all understand that that may be the best for the circumstance. Do we all agree back here? The encyclopedia just told me that she has no say. So the issue is, does Ways and Means have to get involved in this yet? Okay, back to the motion. Let's see, I have some mistypes here. Make motion to renew the motion for 1289 to be referred to Ways and Means. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, we got to adopt the amendment first. Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is added on. Now the motion will be to send the bill to Ways and Means. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, I just wanted to maybe get a couple minutes to explain the bill and what happened and why we're where we are. The original intent of the bill for the prior written notice was that we understand very clearly that our special ed teachers actually have an enormous amount of paperwork and work that they have to do to document for every student that they work with. And so the goal was always to align the requirements at the federal level and the state level so that they're consistent. And what we were seeing was that even though the rules were very similar and almost exactly the same except for just small language around 14-day notice, that there was a huge discrepancy in the paperwork that was actually being submitted. And so our goal was, the intent was to figure out how we can reduce the paperwork for our special ed teachers, but to ensure that then our children and our families still get the notices and the documentation that they need in order for their child to get the best education possible. And so as we were working through this process, we realized that the way the bill was in its original form might not actually achieve that. And so during the process between the referral and when it got to here, all the parties that have been involved, our teachers, our advocates, our parents, they all got together and said that they actually would like to do a work group so that they could all come together for a recommendation and how we can better align what is happening at the state level so that it is more consistent with what the federal government is requesting of them. And so in this delete all amendment is actually we're requesting that we have a prior written notice working group, and in the bill outlines the in the House file it outlines the different aspects of who would be included and how we would be doing this. And so the hope is that the work group has to have individuals appointed by July 1st of 2019, and then by and then the work group must make recommendations by January 15th of 2020. And so that is the bill that is before you now, and I will take any questions. I do have a testifier here, and if I know that you're short on time, so if you would like to hear from the testifier, we'll go ahead and do that. But if you are would just like to move to questions, I'll leave that up to the committee to do.
We can go to questions. Any members or questions for the members of the committee? Everybody understands what we're doing.
Additional people that want to testify.
Okay, we just got notice that this should be referred to education policy as amended.
It's like I saw the future.
Your man.
With that notification, anybody have any questions of the author of the bill under the understanding that it's going to go? Ah, yes. Thank you. Please come forward, read your testimony.
My name is Rick Keller. Unofficially represent people that are gender print disabled and twice exceptional. It's unofficial. You'll find twice exceptional in House File 1380 on line 1.18, and then the people with print disabilities found in the Higher Education Act of 2008 and the ID Act of 2004. Regarding House File 1289, delete 5, one thing that's missing here, or it's my suggestion, if somebody wanted to provide an oral amendment, is to include twice exceptional or gifted and talented, because there's currently a non-definition in statute that that's a group we need to consider, because special ed can be twice exceptional if you're going to have somebody that's going to be appointed to a working board or group. And I believe working groups do not have to comply to Chapter 13, which is transparency, accessibility, public meeting law. So that's what I have to suggest for today. Thank you.
What I might offer is that this is going to go back to policy, maybe work with the author as to the issue and see if it finds a better place to be heard in the policy committee. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to my good friend here who's testifying. I think that he makes a very valid point. We will actually have greater conversation around this, but because this is a work group specifically looking at IEP plans, that this would impact students that actually have one of those, and that we're working towards reducing that type of paperwork. And so we'll make sure that if there's anybody who's been excluded from this group, we'll consider it. But I know that a lot of the GT students generally are not on IEP plans, and there are maybe groups that we have that we might have overlooked, but we will definitely have greater conversation to see if anybody else is missing from this.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the amendment on line 1.15 and line 1.16. It says meetings at this working group are subject to requirements of Minnesota statutes Chapter 13D. I believe that's what Mr. Heller is, and maybe I'm wrong. I guess I'm getting a shake of the head from Ms. Dyson.
That's exactly right, Chair, Mr. Nelson. And one thing that has to come to this meeting, too, is because we currently have we have a school district and state agency involved here. We got the Purpich Center that may be impacted, as well as the blind academies and deaf. So that's the other piece of this, because this does affect the agency, and that's one other reason why it's here, too. So thank you again for that correction, Mr. Nelson. to the chair.
Do you have any comments to that, Representative Herr?
I do not, Mr. Chair, but it looked like the staff might have had a comment on it. Was I incorrect in what I saw? Okay. Did you have a comment? Mr. Chair, we will definitely look at this and ensure that if somebody has been excluded from this, that we ensure to include them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Closing remarks.
No, just thank you for letting it come here, and sorry for any confusion it might have caused. Thank you.
Members, I renew my motion that this will be referred to Ed Policy, now that we've got that sorted out, as amended, and all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Mueller. No. Lippert. Let's see, Joachim. Pardon me?
Is there a co-author on any of these bills on the committee?
Not on my notes. Hey, Lipper's on his way, so I think we may be efficiently able to wait.
The other one's coming too.
I'm not defining what efficiently would be. Representative Mueller has arrived. We will move forward. As you are comfortable, introduce yourself and introduce your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Kelly Mueller here, and I have a bill, House File 1390. This bill is related to IEPs for students and special ed paperwork. I don't know if you've been hearing about any of those in this committee, but in education policy, we've been talking about ways to reduce paperwork for teachers, for special ed teachers, and this bill is just one of the mechanisms to do that, but it does have a rulemaking provision in it.
I need to move and get your bill on.
That's right. Here. We do need to do that.
So I'll make the motion that the bill 1390 will be recommended and sent to Ed Policy. So for those of you that have notes otherwise, that's where we're sending it, is to Ed Policy. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the provisions that this committee are relevant to this committee begin at line 3.22 to 3.25. I don't plan on having any testimony, but I'd have someone here to answer questions if you've got them.
Any questions relative to 1390? Mr.
Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The two things I'm curious about are anonymity and when the rules and stuff are drafted to be able to appropriately de-identify when you start moving it into the larger pool. The other thing is also how this would combine into the effect on school performance and those measures. And again, you'd have to write the rules on how this would be worked into, meeting the, general effectiveness when they evaluate school sites. Because what you're doing is adding the capability of more reporting. And then how is that reporting handled, both the data and the aggregating into the greater decision-making?
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam. So this bill is actually reducing the amount of paperwork required for special ed teachers by saying that schools have the option of including the statewide and test within the IEP. Right now, a lot of schools are interpreting the rule to require them to include that information. And so this would just make clear that schools don't have to include that. Parents are already getting that information about their students. I've got kids in public schools. They get detailed information about how students are performing on those tests. This just removes this from the IEP process if they don't want to include that.
Representative Quam.
The question is, especially when you decrease the quantity of students in a pool, it becomes even more important to have appropriate controls on anonymity. And that's why the question was about implementation of anonymity. The other thing is that when you are going to more of a standardized reporting structure, and you do have, IEP and other circumstances, then how are you handling that effect, since the greater standardized data is utilized in effectiveness monitoring of the schools? How are you handling that? So I understand what you're saying. I'm not asking about that. I'm asking how you handle the changes and ensuring the anonymity. It's just, if it wasn't this, if it was elections, there was a huge issue with elections because in small polling locations, and you have an assistive ballot, if you went to this small ballot and it's assistive and you only had one or two people in that whole district that had that, that precinct, then it's harder to be anonymous, and so that they have rules. If there's a recount, it goes to somebody outside. So I'm just curious, in this educational setting, what's the approach you're looking at for the rules
anonymity? Sure, we're still in the
Are, because it's implementation of the rules, because we're changing the structure at which things are happening, and because it definitely is in there, because it's relational to the same thing we have debated in this committee in previous terms, having to do with the anonymity of voters. So, that I'm just trying to get it on. Right. Or has the author and the people working on this not looked at that? And so, therefore, this is new, and then they will have to try and, understand? Or you're just trusting that somebody will write rules that will be just fine?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I'm not understanding the anonymity piece. I don't believe that that's impacted by what we're trying to do here. I have a testifier here, and maybe she can try to address that further.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kim Lewis. I'm with Minnesota School Boards Association, and to give you a little background, this is one piece of a larger package of six bills that special education teachers and directors came to us with. This bill specifically, a student in Minnesota is a general education student first and foremost. So regardless of an IEP status or not, they are a general education student first. When they take, for instance, I'm going to use the example of MCAs, they have the same, their parents or guardians receive the same information as a regular education student. So when they take the MCAs, if it's applicable, some students are not able to do that because of the various degrees of their disabilities or abilities. If they take the MCA, those results are distributed to parents and guardians regardless of an IEP status or not. So they both get the same information. So there's no, if I'm understanding your question a little bit, you're concerned about which groups might be identified at some point in time. This is not anything to do with that. What we're saying is that when a teacher is using an IEP plan, that they may or may not, this rulemaking changes it to say that they are allowed to but not required. Right now there's a misalignment in rule and statute. So the rule says that they shall, and the statute is more permissive. So we're trying to get it into alignment. That's the whole purpose of this, is just that one sentence to say that they're allowed to consider, they're allowed to do it, but they're not required. As a part of writing a child's IEP plan, they can put those test results in, but it's not required. If it benefits the student and the IEP, then they can, they're allowed to do it. But they, otherwise it's duplicative because the parents are getting the information. There's no assignment of who's taking the test, what race, what any of the things that might benefit from an anonymity, to your point. That's not a part of this proposed legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having been on a school board, having been on a special education district board, having chaired the special education district board, I understand what you're saying. Having spent several terms on the education committee, I also understand that all that data goes up to the Department of Education. And there are processes to make sure there's anonymity, and you take the data, and that's, and I'll hit it offline. I'm just trying to look at some of those issues, and maybe it's more in the weeds because, again, I've had that experience before coming in here, and I've had debates in committees before, and rulemaking is never as trivial as some people try to make it.
Representative Eichen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand what the nature of the disconnect is here. So I think that what this bill is getting at is just the reporting to the parent. Right. Okay, and what Representative Quam is talking about, I'm pretty sure, correct me if I'm wrong, is the aggregate reporting of results by the school district on performance. And which is where the question of the de-identification of the data becomes very important, because if you're reporting aggregate results of performance at the class or the school level, and this particular class only has one such student in it, in that aggregate reporting, you pretty much everybody knows who that one student is if there's only one student of that type. So, but I think this. My reading, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, is that this just relates to whatever the reporting that is made from the school to the parent, not the what's published to the general public.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, so it is reported in the IEP, so the school teachers and administrators would have access to that information too, not just the parent.
But not the general public.
Right, that's correct.
Is that...
Representative Nelson.
No, that's not.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
It all goes to the Department of Ed.
Mr. Chair and members, and when I'm reading when the Representative Mueller and when the testifier talked about it, and then I reread the bill here, what we're doing here is we're putting in statute the rule, which is that, and that's the line two, the addition on line 2.15 to 2.17. And if you read the rule, and 3.22, the rulemaking piece of this, we're instructing the Commissioner of Education to amend the rule to match what we have in statute and so that they align. And that's what we're doing here. We're not authorizing new rulemaking. This would be, I think, expedited. I'm not got the right term, but what's that?
Expedited
rulemaking. Thank you. This is expedited rulemaking because we're changing the statute. We're telling to change the rule to match the statute as opposed to going through the normal rulemaking process. It does nothing to do about any touch the parts that Representative Kwan was worried about, and he's got good worries about that, but I don't think it touches that part. We're just telling the Commissioner of Education to change the rule to match what we have in statute, and we have that authority.
Mr. Heller.
Rick Heller, unofficially represent the twice exceptional people with print disability. I spoke previously on 1390. Keep you abreast. I went to a special education advisory committee last month. They're struggling with to consider to moving the cap for the developmental and cognitive disability from the 1%, the federal cap, to 1.4. To amend the rule so it aligns with the statute, there's something to greatly consider. There's only two types of IEPs. standard base IEPs, which is based on the, correct me if I'm wrong, and a modified, which is not aligned to a student's performance based to their non-disabled peers. Currently, there's no checkbox to let parents know what the difference between a standard-based IEP is, which basically means you will take the MCAs, threes. However, if they want to make a notation, but if every kid could learn, and it's not a modified IEP, parents need to know that they're still developing the special education forms from 2015 under a request from the legislature. But just to not to have a rule meeting and include if it's a standard-based IEP, then that needs to be on there because, correct me if I'm wrong, the State Department's here. Otherwise, if I don't, you don't hear from them, it's correct because this is not a hearing. This is not a trial. Some parts of the MCA standards are done in the classroom. And since the MCAs are summative, which is a no-can-do assessment, which is an independent piece, where the formative assessment is, for instance, the NWA. It's math testing. That's a formative, which is instructional. So if we're doing classroom checks and what they can do independently in the classroom, and they have goals and objectives because there's more than one piece in language arts that are done in the classroom, and I think, I believe, I know that's correct. Correct me if I'm wrong. The piece of this is, if we're going to let up to the IEP team, how will they know? And if the rule doesn't say if it's standard-based IEP, they still need to do it because apparently the rules are trumping the statute. But if you do this properly, it would be a mistake just to change the rule because you need to have that discussion so parents know in the rule writing process know, is it a standard-based IEP or a modified IEP? And that's my suggestion. And then I'd ask that you create a sonar hearing because that's really what's going on here. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your comments. Committee members, any other questions? Okay, we're at this point. Do you have any closing remarks?
I don't, Mr. Chair, members, other than just to say that Representative Nelson, I think you said it perfectly what we're trying to do with this bill and what the scope of the rulemaking is in front of the committee today. So I'd ask for your support. Thank you.
Members, the next. Sorry. I renew my motion that House File 1390 will be referred to Ed Policy and recommended to be referred to Ed Finance. Maybe that should be out.
It's just Ed Policy.
Just Ed Policy. Okay. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Lippert. Editing on the fly. It's a little bit.
I still haven't done my bill.
Oh, no.
Stay.
Is there an
author's
name?
No, there's no author's name.
Oh, okay.
So she's handing out a new copy.
So everybody got the new copy of this. There was a copier error, so that one, the bottom line of 2.32 was clicked off in the original version. So be sure that you're working from the correct.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I'll move the next bill in the agenda is 1414. We'll recommend it to be referred to the General Register. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1414 calls on the Commissioner of Education to adopt a model comprehensive sexual health curriculum for students in Minnesota. This model comprehensive sexual health curriculum will provide information that's medically accurate and developmentally appropriate in regards to human anatomy, reproduction, and sexual development. It will be inclusive of relationships involving diverse sexual orientations and gender identities. It will teach abstinence, and it will teach accurate information about contraceptives and their use. Finally, the curriculum will also be teaching youth about bodily autonomy and consent as well. School districts and parents will still be in the driver's seat. If school districts don't feel the model program is a good fit for their district, they can provide assurance that they have chosen another curriculum. If parents don't feel that the model program is a good fit, they can pull their children from the programming based on the parental view requirements in Section 120B.20. The reason this bill is being heard in this committee is because of language that requires the commissioner to use the rulemaking process under Section 14.389, including a hearing through Subdivision 5 in selecting the model curriculum and communicating with members of the school district about the model program. With me is Caitlin Snyder to say more about the rulemaking process and how it will apply.
Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Members of the committee, my name is Caitlin Snyder. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education. The relevant language in front of you today in Representative Lippert's bill is on line 1.10, which would require the department to adopt a model plan following the expedited rulemaking process under 14.389. So what that would look like is drafting our rules, preparing the expedited rules for comment, giving notice through our agency public alert systems, reviewing comments that are obtained from the public and making any modifications as necessary, holding a hearing if we're receiving enough public comments, working with the governor's office, adopting the rules, and then working with the Office of the Administrative Hearings. This is a little bit different than typical rulemaking in that we're not adopting a rule, we're adopting a model plan, but the layout would work similar to the rulemaking that this committee reviews every day.
Okay, thank you. Committee members, any questions? I guess I should ask, is there anybody else that wants to testify? You're in the audience? Okay. Committee members, any questions? Not seeing any. I'll renew my motion for 1414 to go to the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Joaquin, Representative Joaquin.
Oh, I'm integrating my pile with yours, Nelson.
I got a few things.
See, tell Lily. Lily, me and Nelson are stacking up our things together. Oh, you're shushing me now. Didn't you see how that turned out for him?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a discussion with the former legislator, and I want to thank Chair Nelson for communications on a question with an expert. And a lot of stuff happens offline, and I just want to acknowledge that there is cooperation.
Good.
and help. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we have hurried to arrive at this final repose. And there she is. Thank you for arriving.
Yes. Mr. Chair, timing is always of the essence, right?
We wait in with bated breath.
Mr. Chair, did you want to move the bill in front? Did you already move the bill?
Can you get close enough to the mic?
Sorry, Mr.
My
Chair.
My hearing is very bad.
Did you already move the bill in front of the committee?
I have not yet, so I will. I will move House File 1415 to be recommended and referred to Education Policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You have House File 1415 before the committee today because of the rulemaking component in it. So a little background quickly. In 2017, the legislature passed legislation combining the services provided by the Board of Teaching and the Minnesota Department of Education's Educator Licensing Division into one entity, the Professional Educators Licensing and Standards Board, lovingly called PELSB. This board was charged with implementing a new tiered licensure system. PELSB has been functioning in this new structure for almost a year now, and with all new things, sometimes they need a few tweaks after they've been up and running for a while. You will see those practical changes reflected in House File 1415 as amended before you today, and we've already heard this bill in Ed Finance. So in particular, this committee, I think, is focusing on the provisions regarding rulemaking in Section 22, Subdivision 7 on lines 12.7 to 12.12. And I have Michelle Hirschbott here, who's PELSB's rulemaking specialist, to answer any questions you may have about what the rulemaking process would look like for them. And I stand for questions.
Do you want to have, she's not going to testify, just ask questions, answer questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Plum.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at the change of the composition and some boundary conditions on the members of the board, and having knowledge of why some of those things were situated before, I'm confused because there are multiple court cases of which the board continually lost, and that precipitated the change in the generation, the consolidation, and et cetera. And I'm just wondering why you are changing. In other words, you're removing the restriction in regards to people coming back to the board that were on the previous board that lost, a dozen or more cases, weren't implementing and abiding by what was passed by the legislature?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crom, can you point me to the section you're actually looking at? Because I thought we were just going to be talking about the section in rulemaking here.
Well,
because we've discussed all
Mr. Chair,
policy already.
Because we do run through the chair. Mr. Chair, as I stated, it's a changing the composition of the board. And changing the composition of the board, because I think one of the other members of this committee mentioned that part of the reason why we were hearing a previous bill today was that it created in a board and had to do with that board or work group, etc.
Cheryl.
And frankly, it'd be nice if the author, if you're changing this board, you're taking off restrictions or the parameters of who can and when and et cetera serve on that board. And I'm not sure if you were around, Mr. Chair,
probably not,
when we had all the issues and it was very deliberate, the restrictions that were put on in the statute, restricting the people that totally ignored the legislators, not just intent, but actually the law that was passed and signed in. And that precipitated the very dramatic, you normally don't restrict some, but have restrictions on people who have been on an existing board when you reconstitute it, unless there's a reason. And I'm trying to understand why the author is doing that to the structure of the board.
Representative Yocum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, thank you for that little bit of background. We did discuss this in Ed Policy. What really we're talking about, starting on Section 5 and moving into some of the language you were talking about on 4.6 and 4.10, is the transition language. This was the language that was put in to put the board into place when they were combining the two boards. Now that they have transitioned, like I said before, and they've been functioning for a year, some of that transition language they don't need anymore because now they're up and running as PELSB. So now Palsby has come and said, we want, now that we've transitioned out, let's clean up the statute and move forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as Representative Kwan pointed out, that yet we are also changing the makeup of the board. We're adding a couple more teachers from 6 to 8 and a couple other things. So this part is something that is dealt with the government operations. So this is part of what we should be looking at also, along with the rulemaking process. Representative Kwan is correct in that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Actually, on 3.22, 23, and 24, this no longer needed transitional. If I take the 4 year on 23 and the add it to the from September 1, 2017, I come up with 2021, which I don't think has expired yet. So it's, we're still within that transitional period, and so therefore it's not obsolete, as the author stipulated as to why they were getting rid of that. I'm sure it was just an oversight, unless adding 4 to 2017 doesn't equal 2021.
Representative Yocrine.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Kwan. Yes, you're right. And I have, that was not, our intent is clear to just get rid of the transition language, but I'll let Ms. Vaught explain that.
Hi, my name is Michelle Hirschvaught, and I'm with Palsby. The intention of the board language, the bill's intention for the board language is to help remove transition pieces. There is language adding board members, and that's to help with the extra work that is come onto the board as part of this transition. As mentioned earlier, Palsby is implementing an entirely new tiered licensure system, and so the additional board members would help support do that work. As for the transition at 322 through 325, the intent again was to remove language about the transition, of which one of our board members, who is part of the Board of Teaching, as soon as there's a new appointee, will be replaced entirely. And then the last board member from the Board of Teaching will be replaced at the end of his term.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the update. But I guess I'd feel more comfortable if we actually waited to delete the language until it went through and it actually became obsolete. But on to the two new members, I'm trying to understand. Previously taught for at least 5 years in a birth through grade 12 setting, presently in our, for teaching licensure for pre-K to 12, I don't think we start at birth, so you could conceivably have somebody that worked with children in a daycare center setting for 5 years and worked with infants, and that would meet the qualification. I would think you would want somebody that had taught at least 5 years in actually what is defined for the Department of Education's pre-K through 12 range. And I'm sure that was just an oversight that you'd have somebody outside the actual boundaries, because I don't think we go down to infants, 1 year olds, 2 year olds, and I just think, I assume the intent is to get someone with experience applicable in the licensure areas, and unless I'm mistaken, we don't have the education Department of Ed and the licensure program go all the way to birth quite yet.
Representative Yocrine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kwan, actually we do. There's quite a few early childhood licensings that do go through Palsby, including early childhood special ed. So they are licensing those teachers at the current time. So they want somebody that's representative on the board.
Mr. Chair, so that's from birth?
Yes, it is, sir.
And what are these settings?
Mr. Chair, I could tell you about the one I worked in, Representative Quam. I was working as a para in an early childhood special ed class, and I, in particular, was in a three-year-old classroom, but we had birth to five in the school building that was with early childhood special ed. And there are some early childhood family educators that are licensed through PELSBY as well. So they just want to make sure they have representation on the board when it comes to making decisions about their licenses.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for that. Having been on a school board, and we did have child care, you know, available, and having, you know, been involved with a special education district and special ed programs, I wasn't aware that we had a licensure requirement that covered before age three. When was that implemented? And was that something the board did on its own, or was there enabling language that was passed into law?
Representative Yukmin.
Mr. Chair, PELSBY has said that they'd be more than happy to follow up with you to go through all the licenses that they cover. I don't think, beginning at birth, I don't think we have the statutory language in front of us, but they rest assured PELSBY does license teachers from birth to 12th grade.
Mr. Chair, repeating the part of the question, I wasn't aware of enabling language in statute, and so I was trying to understand when they started, they extended beyond age three to birth, and if you could get the language in statute that authorized, you know, enabled this. Or, and also when they made the decision and it was implemented.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I'm sure PELSBY can do a follow-up with you on that.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Representative Goldman? Sir.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to roll call.
Mr. Heller?
Rick Heller, once more on House File 1415, on line 6.1. I'm not familiar with the language, but obviously the graduate piece and with the tier thing going on, I'm assuming, what I'm not sure what programming completer is. I don't know if it's a new term or is it, I don't see the definition anywhere. To the chair, I was wondering if the author could, one of these people could explain what that is, a program completer.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Bach can take
that.
You
okay.
Chair, we are looking at Section 11 of the bill, and this language is intended to align with language that's used in national survey, a national survey that all teacher preparation programs in Minnesota are required to use. So the terminology in this bill is intended to align with the national survey that's currently in use by all teacher preparation providers. So that program completer term is what they use.
Oh, so if I understand it correctly, this is a national term? Is that correct? Okay, and it doesn't tell us the national term. Assume that that's what, why it's in statute, doesn't refer to any federal law on that. Is that correct? Or do you have something within your own policy that when this gets in the statute?
I think we just stepped outside of the committee. Can that discussion take place outside of the committee so that you can get your information and I?
Well, I just, so when the people look at it, you know what it's referring to, because she said something about federal, but federal isn't reported here. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
First, I'll renew the motion. I'm sorry. Any final remarks that you want to make?
Actually, I just want to thank the discussion. I know Friday hearings can be hard and very long. I used to be the CA for Senate Judiciary, so I know how that goes. I think we all share the goal of having licensed and highly qualified teachers in our classroom, PALSBY helps make that happen. This bill will make sure that they have the tools to do that, and I ask for your support.
With that, members, I'll renew the motion to House File 1415 and to be referred to education policy. So we'll be, there was a request for a roll call, so there will be a roll call, and the clerk will call the order.
Excuse me, I have a bit of a cold. Representative Sauk.
Yes.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Bonner. Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Gomez.
Yes.
Representative Cagle.
Yes.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas. Representative Heinrich. Representative Lehman. Representative Nash. Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Tice. Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative West.
There being 9 ayes and 2 nays, the bill is agreed to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
To add policy.
Yep, we just wanted it back in our jurisdiction. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have circuitously arrived at the end of the agenda. I apologize for my mucking around, and hopefully we make it through.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.